I suppose that life is not a matter of the number of years you live so much as it is a matter of the experiences you have. Our speaker tonight, I'm sure, would say that he is very grateful for the many wonderful experiences that have punctuated his life's history. He was born in a professor's home, brought up in a professor's home right here amongst us, and the professor was a Shakespearean scholar, so you can imagine what that might have meant. Went to Harvard, and from Harvard went to Union Seminary in New York City, and after these experiences and advantages, he became student minister to graduate students at the University of California, Berkeley, and he was out there 3 years during the free speech movement, and met and knows Mr. Savio and that whole situation, in which I understand he rendered very fine service to all sorts of people out there during that troubled time. He then went to Princeton and is now professor of English at the University of Kentucky. It's a great pleasure for me to introduce Dr. Walter Herbert Jr., who will speak on Melville the Prophet. I might say, Walter, that I understand that there are three times that animals spoke in the Bible. Once when the serpent spoke to Eve in the Garden of Eden, and then when the ass spoke to Balaam, and then finally when the whale said to Jonah, "Thou almost persuadest me to be a Christian."
Things I won't say, but I hope very much that when I'm finished, you'll have some things to say and we can talk and have discussion and so forth. Melville may be discussed as a prophet because for a time he thought of himself as a prophet. And at a quite clearly definable point in his career, he was grasped by the impulse to declare himself concerning ultimate reality and set off in pursuit of a religious vision to surpass in validity everything he'd been taught. At length, his fierce hopefulness was thrown back into itself so that his later religious questionings lacked the titanic self-confidence of this prophetic period. Of course, the fact that Melville for a time thought himself to be a prophet doesn't prove that he was one. We may choose to call him a prophet because he created symbols which help us to make critical features of contemporary experience understandable. For example, Norman Mailer has twice recently invoked the white whale in curiously opposed meanings. In describing the riots at the Democratic Convention in Chicago, Mailer said it was as if Melville's whale had come charging up out of the sea. In describing the first moments of the takeoff of Apollo 11 toward the moon, just as the spaceship was rising from the ground, he likened it to Moby Dick nosing upward with its great whiteness against the blue, which for the spaceship is the sky, and for the whale, of course, is the ocean. That Melville's white whale can be used to characterize a moment of triumph for American life as well as a moment of disgrace suggests something of the depth at which that great mystical beast still cruises in the American consciousness. One of the most penetrating and dismaying comments about our present situation in Vietnam was made recently by an intimate of the Johnson government, who said Vietnam became LBJ's white whale. But if Melville had done no more than to offer us pertinent conceptions by which to elucidate our cultural experience, he would not be a prophet at all. He'd be a pundit, perhaps a great pundit like Alexis de Tocqueville, but not a prophet. For a prophet directs us to something deeper than a diagnosis of our immediate cultural experience, however we may cherish the delusion that our own age is the only thing of ultimate importance we must seek to understand. A pundit gives us his views. A prophet calls us to a deeper life. New insights into our immediate problems are merely a byproduct of that excitement of spirit which he provokes. We pay Melville no great compliment by saying that he is relevant to us. There is an austerity in the prophet, as there is in every master spirit. In one of the many ironies of his career, Melville became a prophet even as he concluded that he was not one. In Moby Dick, Melville achieves a timeless intellectual and moral relevance, even as his spiritual explorations begin to undermine the confidence which sustained them, the confidence that the world would yield a vision of religious truth if stringently taxed for it. We do not celebrate Melville as a prophet today because he emerged from his struggles with a coherent set of beliefs, Christian or otherwise. Kierkegaard declares that the spiritual stature of a man should not be measured by what he affirms, but by what he strives with. Melville's striving with his prophetic mission ruined his contemporary reputation, but it established him as a spiritual giant whose writings afford new insights at each rereading. A prophetic consciousness came upon Melville in 1848 as he was writing his third novel, Marty. He had intended to write this novel after the same format which had brought great success to his first two efforts, that is, to make it a humorous story of adventure in the South Seas with hairbreadth escapes and lovely native maidens and ethnologically correct reports on their sexual habits and so on. But after 38 chapters of just that sort of narrative, the story breaks and becomes an allegorical adventure into the world of the mind. The playful tone fades out before a fierce intensity by which Melville drives his hero through along a journey whose stopping places allegorically represent nations, states of the mind, religious convictions, philosophical schools, and so forth. Like Jeremiah, Melville exclaims that his youth makes him unfit for the task so abruptly thrust upon him, saying, "And though essaying but a sportive sail, I was driven from my course by a blast resistless, and ill-provided, young, and bowed to the brunt of things before my time, still bowed before the gale." This crest is religious, in that it examines all its heterogeneous places of sojourn under a single standard, asking whether any provides a fit lodging for the life of the soul. Spiritual discovery in Marty does not result from an effort to understand or realize a single viewpoint to its fullest, but from a ranging effort to test all possibilities. Thus Melville's Voyager tries to discover a golden haven in which the requirements of his soul's life can be met. Melville concedes at the outset that such a place of true peace may not be found, but yet, he says, in bold quest thereof, better to sink in boundless deeps than float on vulgar shoals, and give me, ye gods, an utter wreck, if wreck I do. Melville presents his quester as one who travels amid a diversity of places, because Melville's own experiences had impressed him with the precariousness and relativity of parochial points of view. Melville was acutely aware that conditions of health and wealth and social position can give form to the mind so that men assert as absolute truth views which are in reality determined by limited standpoints. Melville himself had experienced radical changes of fortune, changes which gave him an exceptional opportunity to appreciate that extent to which persons view reality from the bias imposed by social place. Melville was born into a genteel and sophisticated home, the son of prosperous New York businessman His parents had every reason to consider themselves prime citizens of the new American nation. His father had been in on the Boston Tea Party, as a matter of fact, and they kept in the house a little bottle of tea, which had been poured out of his boot when they came home. These people felt themselves to really be, 24-karat Americans. Herman's father considered the family prominence to be a result, at least in part, of their religious faith, and confidently ascribed his own business successes to God's providence. His own sublime assurance of God's unfailing support prompted Herman's father to take dangerous risks. So he's a very adventurous businessman, and his business career was full of emergencies. At such times, in emergencies, and there are plenty of letters to prove this, he typically asserted his belief in providence. The providence was seeing through. When Herman was 11, his father went bankrupt. And after 2 years of trying to get onto his feet, he went mad and died. This disaster led to a drastic reduction in the family circumstances, so that after various futile efforts to find adequate work, Herman was reduced to shipping out as a common seaman, which was a good deal worse in those days than working as a janitor would be now or something. The perplexity and suffering he endured is suggested by a passage in the novel he wrote about that first voyage. "I must not think of those delightful days before my father became bankrupt and died. For when I think of those days, something rises up in my throat and almost strangles me." As Melville unraveled that agonized knot in his throat, he discovered a deep suspicion of the deceptive certainty which the appeal to religious truth can bestow upon complacent delusions like those which had destroyed his father and the fortune altogether. When subsequent voyages took Melville to the South Seas, he was exposed to further evidences of the way in which a religious outlook may distort the facts of experience. It suited the interests of missionaries and their sponsors, Melville found, to depict the native islanders as depraved idolaters and to celebrate the accomplishments of their Christianizers as a signal victory of goodness and truth over falsehood and degeneracy. In truth, Melville concluded, the natives had a life which was valuable and appealing in its own right, however different from life in New Bedford or Boston. While the grandiose missionary rhetoric merely concealed the fact that these natives were being, as Melville says, civilized into draft horses and evangelized into beasts of burden, when Melville returned from his voyaging, he faced the same money problem which had driven him to sea in the first place, and apparently took the suggestion that he write a story based on his South Sea adventure because he had nothing better to do. It's really a fact that the 19th century American writer with the greatest literary gift became a writer by accident, or almost by accident. That's this novel. The result was another lesson, the result of his writing Typee, the first novel, was another lesson in the relativity of social place. Typee was a smashing success, so that the child of privilege turned penniless sailor boy became overnight an internationally famous writer. The upsurge of self-confidence which this must have occasioned was strengthened by the success of his second novel, Omu. And so Melville was moving now in the most brilliant and accomplished social circles of New York and Boston, and married forthwith the daughter of the Chief Justice of the Massachusetts Supreme Court. And it was at about this time, as he was on the bill, that the blast Resistless sprang up, and Melville was thrust into the audacity of prophetic utterance, having witnessed in the South Seas the distortions which limited viewpoints can impose upon experience, and having known in his own person the radical alterations of consciousness which come with drastic changes of fortune, Melville set out to find the truth with a capital T, proposing his own person as the matrix of a new insight into the reality, with a capital R, beyond all parochial viewpoints. This bold effort encountered two difficulties. In the first place, Melville was unable to arrive at a vision of the truth suitable to the yearnings which initiated his effort to find that vision. At the end of Mardi, the hero of the story disappears into further searching over an endless sea. The golden haven in which the soul may swing from secure moorings is never discovered. In the second place, the novel did not sell. It was such a failure with the public that Melville was forced to subdue the prophetic impulse in his next two novels, only to release it again in Moby Dick. In Moby Dick, the prophetic ebullience of Marty yields to deeper and deeper doubts, as Melville is faced with the question how any human consciousness can lay claim to an authoritative grasp on ultimate realities. How is the prophet to know that he is in contact with the divine and not merely enlarging his own preconceptions and fantasies? Melville struggled with this question in full awareness that contemporary religious teachers offered answers to it. The Unitarians, for example, believed that man could achieve knowledge of the divine reality through reason. They taught that man had an innate moral sense, which enabled him to judge accurately the ethical quality of his experience, and that when man applied his intellect to the moral data thus supplied, he would be led to the discovery that the world is ruled by a benevolent creator. Melville presses this Unitarian conception of reason so hard as to make it indistinguishable from madness, praising the great artist as one whose intellect drops down into the universe like a plummet. Melville characterizes the moment of maximum inspiration as enabling the artist to speak what he calls the sane madness of vital truth. The thrust of reason in Melville, rigorously followed, arrives at the derangement of reason. Unitarian reason leads to madness in Melville because he judged the facts of moral experience more severely than the Unitarians did. Melville's first novels, back to type again, involved him in ethical controversies. His attack upon the missionaries of Polynesia aroused such a storm of protest that the offending passages were removed from the second American edition of the book. Melville sought to reconcile himself to these expurgations by saying that the passages in question were digressions from the main line of the narrative. In truth, however, they were no more digressive than many another passage. What distinguishes them is the scorching fury, moral indignation, which bursts through the otherwise easygoing jocularity of the story. Melville charges that what is proclaimed as the evangelization of the natives is in fact their destruction, and his fury at the presumption of moral superiority, of Western moral superiority, on which this outrage has proceeded, prompts violent attacks from Melville on the Western man. For example, the fiend-like skill, he says, the fiend-like skill which we display in the invention of all manner of death-dealing engines, the vindictiveness with which we carry on our wars, and the misery and desolation that follow in their train are enough of themselves to distinguish the white civilized man as the most ferocious animal on the face of the earth. Melville's outrage against the depravities of Western war-making broke out again in White Jacket, another novel that he wrote just before he wrote Moby Dick, which attacked the practice of flogging with such effectiveness that spokesmen for the custom were prompted to defend themselves in print. The keystone of Melville's ethical consciousness was his tenacious belief in the inherent dignity of human beings, what he called that immaculate manliness we feel within ourselves, so far within us that it remains intact, though all the outer character seemed gone. It was this ability to recognize this dignity in primitive islanders and in common sailors which lay behind the rage he felt when he found them degraded by those who had the power to do them harm, and the rationale, often rationale by religious sanction, to regard them as less than human. But Melville's belief in the dignity of man led him to the angry recognition that the helpless are not only victimized by cruel and powerful men, but that life itself brings casualties which are not deserved. The suffering of innocence is sometimes inflicted apparently by chance, as when a lightning strikes a kindergarten. The so-called natural evil of the world produces no intellectual problem for those who believe that men deserve no better. The problem of evil does not result from a belief in God, but from a belief in the dignity of man. Thus his ethical consciousness led Melville to question the justice of God and to embody this anger in a whaling captain who had his leg bitten off by a whale in an act of seeming malice. Thus Captain Ahab seeks revenge for an injury which he considers a deadly affront to his personal dignity. This radical application of the notion of human dignity leads not only to madness, the same madness of vital truth, but to the self-destruction of that moral consciousness from which the logic of Ahab's revenge takes its start. In hunting the whale, Ahab becomes a tyrant himself, no less cruel and wanton than the evil god that he contends with, or that he thinks he's contending with. He inflicts upon his crew agonies no more deserved than those he has suffered. Thus, individual conscience itself, in the cauldron of Melville's radical heat, begins to split apart and disclose its inner flaws and contradictions. The fact that opposition to evil can produce a strange depravity of vengefulness and recklessness becomes, in Melville's treatment, a figure for the inherent weakness of man's moral nature. Pursued to its absolute extreme, the moral sense destroys itself in visions of divine malignity, so that ethical consciousness fails to place man in a harmonious relation to the nature of things, but when tested to its depths, reveals a stubborn opposition between man and ultimate reality. Another avenue toward ultimate truth, which Melville radically questioned, was transcendental vision. Ralph Waldo Emerson had announced the dawning of a new age of religious discovery in American life, by which we would, as he said, enjoy an original relation to the universe. Freed from dependence upon creeds of European origin, Americans were to have a poetry and a philosophy of insight, not of tradition, and a religion by revelation to us. Such insight and revelation were to develop, according to Emerson, from the direct access of the mind to God, which man can achieve through nature. Emerson believed that natural objects are symbols of spiritual realities, so that a knowledge of the transcendent could be achieved through an openness to the symbolic potency of material things. Thus he urged men to foster consciousness-expanding experiences, which could gather the individual spirit into the sweep of the divine mind and charge it with the energies of God himself. Melville was capable of profound mystical consciousness, was acutely sensitive to the moral and spiritual suggestiveness of physical objects. His works are pervaded with meditations which are provoked by natural objects or artifacts, and in Moby Dick, his deepest spiritual probings are developed from such moments of insight. Captain Ahab voices the ground for Melville's aesthetic procedure when he declares, "All visible things, man, are but as pasteboard masks. But in each event, in the living act, in the undoubted deed, some unknown but still reasoning thing puts forth its features through the unreasoning mask." In other words, every physical thing around us, like a harpoon or a whale boat or a whale, is simply a pasteboard mask. Behind that mask is something that has intelligence, is a reasoning thing that whose features can be dimly perceived. That's the transcendental insight, see? A moment of perception through the physical object into something beyond it. But despite this reliance upon transcendental insight in the development of his spiritual explorations, Melville warned that such insight could provoke a foolish oblivion to the dangers of life. One of his most compelling evocations of transcendental consciousness presents a poetical young man on a whaling voyage who never finds any whales during his turn to the masthead. And here I give you a long quotation, so you can listen to Melville's prose instead of mine. Here's our young man at the masthead who's shipped out because he wants to see the world. Lulled into an opium-like listlessness of vacant, unconscious reveries is this absent-minded youth by the blending cadence of waves with thoughts. Intellectual material. Waves with thoughts. As he watches the waves, they're blended into one. That at last he loses his identity, takes the mystic ocean at his feet for the visible image of that deep, blue, bottomless soul pervading mankind and nature, and every strange, half-seen, gliding, beautiful thing that eludes him seems to him the embodiment of those elusive thoughts that only people the soul by continually flitting through it. In this enchanted mood, thy spirit ebbs away to whence it came, There is no life in thee now, except that rocking life imparted by a gently rolling ship, by her borrowed from the sea, by the sea from the inscrutable tides of God. But while this sleep, this dream is on ye, move your foot or hand 1 inch, slip your hold at all, and your identity comes back in horror. And perhaps at midday in the fairest weather, with one half-throttled shriek, you drop through that transparent air into the summer sea, no more to rise forever. He did well, ye pantheists. Thus Melville anticipated the fate of the young man in Berkeley, who in the glorious confidence of an acid trip announced that he was going to Europe and walked out of a fifth-story window. Melville's most radical exploration of transcendental consciousness occurs as he tries to suggest the meaning that the white whale had for Ishmael himself. Ishmael tells us that it was the whiteness of the whale that most deeply preoccupied him, not its presumed viciousness. Melville gives numerous instances in which whiteness is associated with a peculiar horror, as for example the traditional foggy milkiness of ghosts, so that the imagination is stretched to its fullest in the effort to gauge the secret meaning which he has promised to disclose. Then, as the reader is straining his intuition to get beyond the suggestiveness of all these white things that Melville brings up in the chapter on the whiteness of the whale, to get beyond this suggestiveness into the inner meaning of the color white, Melville proposes that whiteness is horrific because it stabs us from behind with the thought of annihilation, since, as he says, in essence, whiteness is not so much a color as the visible absence of color. The white horrifies because it has no meaning. It reveals an absence. The mystical quester is not halted by an obstacle. He's stabbed in the back. His faith betrays itself in this ultimate crisis of insight. The thought of annihilation brings the numbing awareness that the spirit of man finds no sympathy with the divine spirit. Is it for these reasons, Melville asks, that there's such a dumb blankness full of meaning in a wide landscape of snows, a colorless, all color of atheism from which we spring? Having established such a fearful significance for whiteness, Melville then proposes that all the color which we see around us is not actually inherent in objects, but is only a cosmetic effect produced by the interaction of light with objects. So that considered apart from that deceiving interaction, both light itself and the visible world are in essence totally colorless. In that flash of insight, the great world of nature goes blank and mystical consciousness is negated. So, Melville says, the wretched infidel gazes himself blind at the monumental white shroud that wraps all the prospect around him. And of all these things, Melville concludes, the albino whale was the symbol. Driven to its ultimate limit, therefore, mystical insight liquidates itself. Following the secrets of the universe without reservation, it makes the ultimate discovery that there is no secret. Thus, that transcendental consciousness which took its beginnings in the perception that a congruity exists between man's spiritual ideas and the forms of the material world, that consciousness ends with the discovery that the universe is empty of meaning, a discovery that sends mystical consciousness crashing in upon itself. Thus, in Moby Dick, two human faculties are explored for their capacity to yield an authoritative vision of the ultimate. Both moral sense and transcendental insight, those darlings of the advanced religious thinkers of his day, were extruded by Melville into forms which displayed their inadequacy as guides to ultimate truth. With these discoveries, the groundwork is cut from beneath Melville's prophetic consciousness. In the novel which follows Moby Dick, Melville depicts a young man who follows his mystical insights and moral sense until they lead him to murder and suicide. Melville's thought, therefore, poor Melville, arrives at a skepticism which encroaches upon its own criteria, a doubt so thoroughgoing that doubt itself becomes doubtful. The world of Moby Dick is one in which all gestures toward an ultimate moral or spiritual stability are perpetually undercut. No point of vantage will permit the reader a commanding view of Melville's meanings. His art forbids the development of a unified vision. That, incidentally, is the reason why the question, what does the white whale symbolize, is the biggest boondoggle and for a scholarship. Someone may disagree with that. We can talk about it. But really, if you try to establish a stable focus, he always anticipated that and insinuated materials which throw the focus out a little bit. Reading Melville is, at least in one way, an experience of the demonic energy with which he twists ideals into disturbing symmetries, never permitting us to rest in a single view. Like Picasso, if you will, Melville dismantles reality and reassembles it so as to force us to see it from contrasting perspectives at once. The aesthetic energy, the aesthetic strength by which this occurs is a different issue, and it's quite extraordinary. Melville also shares with Picasso the quality which prompted Paul Tillich to call the Guernica the most profoundly Protestant painting of our time. The Guernica is Protestant because it presents a world incapable of its own salvation. It is a world crying out for a rescue from its evils, but containing no principle within itself by which such a rescue might be achieved. As Melville continued to struggle with religious issues, and he did all the way through the rest of his life, he brooded long over the question whether a certain kind of suffering might be redemptive, a suffering like that of Christ's passion. But now he no longer believed that he himself might be able to resolve the painful enigmas. He had ceased to believe in himself as a prophet. Very well. Or perhaps you'd like to shift your seat for a minute.
Melville offers so many possibilities. some will become empty of that, of any specific meaning, certainly, and perhaps no meaning at all. I don't know whether that's a question or a comment, but perhaps it's a reaction.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose that the maybe to distort what you're saying, to make it really hard to handle, would be to say, well, why bother with this filthy whale if he has all of these different meanings and it's all so much matter of despair anyway. And I suppose that the reason why that doesn't quite happen, at least for me, of course it is a matter of critical judgment, and there are plenty of works which try to get at the meaning of meaning. You know, modern symbolic things where you feel like you break your tooth and get nothing but a worm out of the nut that you're trying to crack. It's not worth the trouble. In Melville's case, one of the things that happens in the book is the tremendous ebullience of his excitement about exploring the possibilities of things is coming to its height just as the countercurrent is cutting back against it. It's like the ninth wave, you know, that he keeps sort of trying to get up on the beach with this surging excitement. And just as the one that's going to throw him back the farthest is rolling back. So there's a tremendous exhilaration of sheer intellectual pyrotechnics in the book. And it's anything but an energy that's affair. And of course, Melville doesn't quit writing at this point. He continues. But I do think that as far as his own consciousness of himself as a prophetic figure is concerned, this tends to wane rather sharply. I think that another thing that can be said is that in Moby Dick, Melville not only examines the question, you know, the symbolic meaning of the world, he also examines the question of how people assign such symbolic meanings. So it's in a way a psychological or a spiritual inward study. And all of this proliferation of different ideas does have a certain unity around this central concern. So it really isn't a great hodgepodge, at least altogether. It tends to go that way. It's such a monstrous thing. Maybe I've said more than I needed to in response to that. Any other? Yes?
You did tell me that at the end of writing, Toby Dick, Melville thought he was less of a prophet than he thought he was when he began to write.
Yes, I suppose that's implied by what I said. As a matter of fact, it isn't true. he was tremendously exhilarated when he finished Moby Dick. He really felt like a god. And he wrote letters to Hawthorne in which he talks about sitting together on the top of Olympus, clanging the glasses together and having achieved this delirious consciousness beyond good and evil, really. But what happens in the next, I mean, he felt very much a sense of triumph and said, you know, they are larger monsters than whales. I have heard of krakens, which I take to be octopuses, giant octopuses, and he plunges into the next book immediately without even taking a breath. And it's in Pierre, in which this brilliance begins to cave in and in which the prophetic excitement begins to go sour, so that I think he had, you know, prepared the grounds for this tumbling disillusion, although he hadn't fully experienced it at the conclusion of the book. Does that come to your question?
I think so. We can rest assured that a wave or two did make it to the shore.
Oh, yeah. Well, they continued to make it this way. The career didn't stop there. It continued to write the thing. Sir? the next thing I need to do with the conference plan is to read it with care. It's been a long time, but there is the following curious thing. That is, the central figure in the book is totally inconsistent.
Yeah.
And the, so that the, from Marty, in which you have the centrality of the seeker who goes to various diverse locations, you have an almost a completely telescope in the pattern is jerked inside out, in which the central figure becomes completely divided within himself. And I think this betokens the something of the fragmentation of consciousness which Melville experienced. Now that's just a really rough and ready response, but that's all I can offer. Yes?
I was wondering about the whiteness of the rail being the conscript nature of the color, whiteness of the absence of color. Mm-hmm. You know today that that's not really true.
Yes, right.
The moment it could not be an inversion of the symbol of purity and not something.
Yes, yes.
You know, the same kind of thing. And then, too, there's the heart of something like a white whale, the albino.
Mm-hmm.
How do you recommend all of these kinds of interpretations?
Well, it mentions everything that you have except for this, so the hot hell and the. He simply offers an enormously lengthy catalog of the symbolic uses of whiteness, and certainly the albino is one, the white race is another. Oh, it's just endless. The white friars and ghosts and all sorts of polar bears and so forth come in, and certainly the symbolisms of purity and holiness of the and he pulls together this enormous variety of symbolic possibilities in order to tickle you into following the suggestiveness to the point at which he gets you far out on the limb, so he can saw it off with this antiquated theory that whiteness is no color at all. Well, it's perfectly true, it's physics, yeah, but the he arrives at this concluding notion after going through just the sort of other, sequence of other possibilities that you were suggesting.
I was wondering if I've ever had a course in physics.
No. He never got to college because of the trouble with money, and he was got sort of halfway through something called Albany Academy. He went to school in New York when his and they lived in New York, and I suppose he had, I can tell you where he got this theory. He got it from Pierre Bayle's dictionary in the article on Descartes, and so that was 1699, and very much out of date even then. But he didn't study physics at all. He was fascinated by all kinds of theories of the psychic or moral significance of physical nature. Phrenology was a great interest of his, side interest. Always trying to get to some moral significance behind the physical. In fact, and of course the time was just filled. He read Paley, the guy that wrote Natural Theology, who has this book which simply gives example after example of how bright God is, because you see, only an extremely intelligent creator could think up something like the eye. Which has muscles on this side, so if you want to look over here, they point that way, and muscles on the other side, look the other way. And this kind of very simple-minded application or effort to derive moral and theological ideas from physical theory was one that Melville was very skeptical about. Yes, ma'am? I offered two possibilities, one of which I think is lesser in weight than the other. The first possibility is that, and Melville, I think, qualifies under both headings. The first possibility is that he, you know, comprehends profoundly currents in American life, the American experience, and a great deal could have been said about that and has been said in print about that. Beyond that, there are what I think is fair enough to call ultimate issues or timeless issues. Melville, in exploring the limitations of man's moral ability, stands in a line of religious meditation which goes right back to Jeremiah, really. And it's in this broader context that I was wishing to speak of him. In a rough and ready way, it's possible to say that what I've described is Melville's appropriation and fresh expression of the concept of the fallen world, that is, of a world which is in need of rescue from beyond itself, incapable of saving itself. And that, of course, is what Tillich in Miami is talking about, Picasso. So that it's a person who touches these issues with the kind of vitality which makes it profitable for us to go to him to learn, you know, about the depth of our own experience. Okay? Yes?
Yeah, we've always been a favorite character of mine.
Yes. Yes, well, Pickering. There are lots of things about Queequeg. One of the first things is that, of course, he is a sort of culmination of Melville's reflections on the South Seas, and in the beginning of the novel, as you know, Ishmael and Queequeg become very, very close. And Ishmael enters imaginatively into the religion of Queequeg, and they offer little burnt shavings and biscuits to the little wooden god. And in these contexts, Melville is, among other things, suggesting the versatility of Ishmael's religious imagination. One of the things that happens in the book is that Ahab has a kind of tunnel vision, focused. Conforming all of his perceptions of the physical world or of the moral world around this ferocious purpose that he has, and this diabolical vision of the quail as a symbol of some sort of evil god. On the other hand, Ishmael, who merges imperceptibly from time to time into the narrative voice of the novel, has this sort of polytheistic generosity of perception, that is, he's ready to go with anything that has any sort of spiritual suggestiveness at all, and I think these opening scenes between Ishmael and Queequeg are rather deliberately and subtly define Ishmael as a wanderer in this specific spiritual sense of a person who is willing to try anything. Beyond that, speaking further about prophetic consciousness, Queequeg becomes a kind of symbol for the enigma of the self. As you know, there are these tattoos all over him, and at first they're extremely horrifying to Ishmael. It's an extremely funny scene, as you may recall, at the beginning of the novel. He's crawling into bed, and this man comes in, and he's all covered with these tattoos, and Ishmael's horrified. So the tattoos begin as a kind of symbol for this horrifying remoteness and strangeness, which arouses the utmost squeamishness in Ishmael, the terror of the unknown, which he then becomes close to. And as the novel proceeds, these tattoos become a kind of hieroglyph of the mystery of the inner man, the mystery of the self. which Ahab, among others, tries to penetrate this secret. And in the end, the hieroglyph is unreadable. Queequeg appears in a lot of other contexts, too. But one of the things I think about the novel at large is that, unlike many great works of art, it only to a limited extent are its figures consistent, or do they conform to an easily definable curve or pattern? And in order to talk about Queequeg, you really have to break it down to specific passages, and there are lots of them. So if you'll just let me off of those two. Yes. Continuing to live at all is of any moral significance. The book begins with with Ishmael and the toils of you know, brooding about suicide and stopping in front of coffin warehouses and insensibly taking up the rear of every funeral procession that goes by, and asking questions about the about that, you know, the actual substance of life itself. So that simply to offset the tendency of this argument that I think you're alluding to, you could make a very strong case that there are lots of evidences in the novel that simply continuing to exist is a fairly mean reward, considering the depth of the questions that have been raised. And I reject the argument that his survival is a reward for having come to a greater understanding. Yes?
Back when the evening, William Hamilton spoke here, and he said that we were going toward a kind of continued a food or detached polytheism. In which we would build communities where original sin would have no place. What we feel about this?
This talk that you just did has something to do with outermost deities.
Well, I'd like to hear more about it. No, as far as polytheism is concerned, I think that that's nothing new. If it's understood in any reasonable sense, as, you know, as a God being some sort of value center, I think we live in a very polytheistic society today. I think we always have. A formal polytheism is maybe something different. But about that, I don't know. You know, the notion of building communities in which original sin has no place. Suggests a kind of fantasy as far as I can see. I mean, original sin isn't something, as far as I can see, that we've built in, so I don't see that we can very well build it out. I mean, it would appear, at least to me at any rate, that it's something that we have to face every time we move our hand to build anything. And that it simply isn't going to be eliminated like measles. Our measles happen and I lost track. But I'd be inclined to be rather skeptical about that sort of thing. Perhaps that's good enough. Let's just take one more and then that'll. Did you? Yes?
Yeah, your recitation at the beginning of that novel reminded me of how funny a great deal of Toby Dick really is. It has the element of, at least to me anyway, of a Western tale in that way. But how did that or does it fit in with what you arrived about tonight? What effect does the humor have on all these serious questions?
Well, there are two answers. One of them is Melville had a terrific sense of humor. He was often very bawdy, and there's a lot of really bawdy humor in Melville. I encourage you to look for it. He was just full of it, and he was a great locker room humorist. Capable of really genuine high spirits. At the same time, the humor is also a kind of reflex in certain places in Moby Dick, a kind of manly effort to face down all of this darkness. And at one point, you perhaps remember a chapter called The Hyena, Laughing Hyena, in which he says, "Oh, sometimes you simply have to conclude that life is a great big practical joke." And it's very amusing, and he has enough of brilliance to carry it off. But other times that humor tends to darken and become something rather ghoulish. But but that's a very extensive. So there's a book on the subject. I'll tell you the title if you remember. Fine. Well, that's, I think.